Okay, this is talking with William Gordon at IRSI in Helsinki on 4th August 78. Well, could you just tell me when you first came into contact with radio astronomy? And
well, the early contact was in 1947 when I earned my stipend at Cornell as a graduate student using a rig that Charlie Seeger had put together to monitor solar radio noise at a couple hundred megahertz.
This is an electrical engineering department?
I was in the electrical engineering department. I was a graduate student. And at that stage, Charlie Burroughs was, and throughout my degree, was my major professor. Henry Booker arrived a year or two after I did and was very influential in my career. With Henry, we looked at the propagation of radio waves beyond the horizon by scattering, now called the tropospheric forward scatter.
Right.
And it became a big business, and it got us, it produced a thesis for me.
What was Burroughs' area of expertise, if I may just ask?
He was a radio wave propagation man who had been at Bell Labs for a number of years, and during the war was very much involved in the war effort and radio waves and what happens to radars as they're influenced by weather. And after the war, he went to Cornell, where he was director of the department.
Do you remember what his motivation was for setting up a small radio astronomy program? Or?
Well, I suspect he was just aware that the war had produced interference to radars, which turned out
just something to find out about.
Not quite begin radio astronomy,
right,
because Rieber and other Jansky,
right,
previously done some related things. Well, my motivation that led to the Arecibo dish was really radio scattering, wherein I did a thesis in the troposphere, which was successful. I did some work on the stratospheric radio wave scattering, which produced communication lengths of the order of 600 miles compared to the, say, 200 for the tropospheric scattering. Henry did the ionosphere forward scatter, which produced communication over 1,000 miles or so, and was a big part of the military dual-line communication operation. So we were electrical engineers involved in communication, and we're exploiting radio scattering.
But also ionospheric physicists.
Yeah, well, it was working its way up. You see, we started in the troposphere because there were problems to deal with, and we got them, at least theoretically, in what we thought was a reasonable state. And then simply said, well, if it happens there, won't it happen higher up? And of course, the effects were there, and they could be predicted, and really have a use, I think a significant use as communication channels. Well, it was somewhat, let's see, I got a degree in 1953, my PhD from Cornell. In 1958, still going along the same lines, I was wondering, we had the forward scatter by ionosphere propagation Henry had done, Booker, and I wondered, was there not any other kind of scattering that might occur in the ionosphere? Because by then we were beginning to think about ionosphere. I was beginning to think about ionosphere physics. And I did the classical calculation of the scattering from a single electron.
Right. It
had been done many times before. But in the process, I did it and could push it through, which most graduate students could also do. But then if you put that together with the availability of hardware in those days, you could say there is scattering from individual electrons. It's extremely small, but hardware has come a long way since the war. And if you put together the best transmitter that was available and made some selection of wavelength to minimize the sky noise versus the equipment noise, found your way into an appropriate wavelength region.
What
brought us down to about a meter, and the final selection for Arecibo was 70 centimeters. But it was a fairly flat minimum. But what it said was that you could detect in the ionosphere the number of electrons. Mm-hmm. The electron density is a function of height. It's the kind of thing that an ionogram produces on the bottom side, and the the Alouettes now, or the topside sounders now produce on the topside. But you could do it from the ground at a frequency that normally you would have said it was the ionosphere was transparent to.
Right.
You could do it all the way through. And when you just put it all in the radar equation, which was appropriate for a beam-filled situation like the ionosphere, it then turned out that you needed a very large antenna, and in round numbers it was 1,000 feet, and that was a nice number to settle on. It was big and challenging, and it was a very exciting time for us to run around to the civil engineers and the mechanical engineers and see what they thought about.
Could you build
a 1,000-foot dish? So the spring of 58 at Cornell was a very exciting time. It had nothing to do with radio astronomy.
Right.
And it wasn't difficult to sort of get study money to look into it. The ONR, almost within a week, produced money that we could...
Those were the days.
Exactly. And in those days, if you thought about the NSF as a source, you quickly said they're not a possibility because the amount of money we're talking about is in the millions, and they were really just getting started, but they weren't very far along.
Very low level compared to the military, right. Yeah.
Well, it then became apparent that if you could measure things like electron density, and there's some development, some thoughts going into the theory of what was going on, as well as the hardware side of it. You could not only measure the electron density, you could measure the electron temperature, the ion temperature, maybe something about composition,
mm-hmm.
as all of these as functions of height, essentially, continuously. And it quickly developed that was the kind of information that the military people were interested in, because they were thinking of men at that stage, and missiles, of course, in the upper atmosphere, and not long after that, men. And so ARPA, the Advanced Research Projects Agency, was the only source that had the courage and the resources to look at a project of that size. So we spent a lot of time commuting from Ithaca to Washington, selling them on the project. Wardlow, who was the man who was responsible, who was in IDA, the Institute for Defense Analysis, the advisors of ARPA, was quite influential in the following sense. That when we went in, we said, look, we could build a 1,000-foot parabola, and it would have almost no motion of the beam, but it would do all of these things about the ionosphere. And Ward knew that there were some people at Cambridge, Air Force Cambridge Research Lab then, who were experimenting with spherical antennas.
I see.
And they had built a 10-foot dish and had built a line feed to correct the spherical aberration.
Mm-hmm.
And he knew that was going on. So he challenged us in a sense by saying, you really don't want to build a 1,000-foot dish with a 1-degree scan.
Mm-hmm.
You want to build it with some tens of degrees of scan. And he said, why don't you go talk to the blacksmith and his colleagues at Cambridge? So we did.
Now, this Lowe, is that L-O-W?
Yeah,
Wardlow.
Yeah. And blacksmith and, several others, Boucher, Shell, who's here at the, Alan Shell, who's here, all have been either in-house or under contract producing the feed, which was the critical problem, not the spherical dishes, relatively easy to produce. But they had produced some line feeds, which were moderately successful.
What was their motivation?
Their motivation was to get a situation in which you could have a fixed dish, and by scanning a feed, you could get a...
So once again, you could do a large dish.
Instead of picking the dish up and
I assume that you didn't even really spend any serious time thinking about a movable dish of that size.
No, at 1,000 feet, it was clear that we needed... the CEs told us what you need is a hole in the ground of the right size, and you're going to shape it a little and hang or sit in the hole.
Right.
And you're not going to pick that up. But it was also clear that the style of a spherical dish, you could conceive of building a superstructure on which you supported the line feed and moved it from one radius to another. And as you move it from one radius to another, you move the beam, which is parallel to that radius. So the Air Force Cambridge got into the a business with us through ARPA, and between the summer of 1958 and the summer of 1960, we had hired, we had developed the idea to the point that ARPA said they would be willing to invest substantial amount of money. We'd hired A&Es through an architect-engineer firms through a competition. It was a cooperative thing at Cornell of EEs and CEs primarily. Mm-hmm. Bill McGuire in civil engineering, George Winter were the principal CEs, and Henry Booker, Ben Nichols, Marshall Cohn involved on the EE side. And so we put together proposals, and you know, the detail work had to be done externally.
Right.
Now, so what we have at this stage is a facility which would not only see all of the properties that I mentioned earlier straight overhead, but would see them in a cone. And the cone angle turned out to be 20 degrees half angle, which we thought was marvelous, but difficult. But the structure...
Difficult to make something that would...
Yeah, it was the structural problem.
Around,
yeah. The line feed was a separate problem, and Alan Kay had a company of his own. And
were there problems
designed
thought the that feed. It just wouldn't scale up, or was it just a matter of supporting the line feed?
No, the supporting. You're talking about a 100-foot long, roughly 100-foot
right.
long, slim column of wave back, and it had to be self-supporting over that. So there were interesting challenges all through.
And none of these had been looked at before, of course.
The biggest one was 10-foot-ish before, and so in effect we were scaling up by two orders of magnitude in the linear dimension.
Yeah.
And that was a big scale. But with the encouragement of the Cambridge people and the support of the ARPA people, we were able to get on with the design of a 1,000-foot spherical dish, which would have this 20 degrees scannability. It became clear then that if you built a radar of that size, you could not only see things in the upper atmosphere, but you could see the moon, which had only just begun to be marginally detected in those days in 58. And you could make calculations which showed you could easily see the nearby planets. The limit there was going to be the scannability. Would they go out of your field of view? You know, would the Earth sweep you by them before the echo came back?
Right.
And that was an interesting limit.
Which now, of course, is limiting things as far as Saturn goes.
That sort of puts a Saturn limit on if you stay in one station, I guess. So it was clear that you could not only study the ionosphere, but you could do some things in radar astronomy. So that influenced very much the sighting. To do the radar astronomy on the planets, at least, you had to be in the tropics.
Right.
And that pushed us, our civil engineer friend said, where do you want to go? Well, you can find holes in the ground in Mexico, Bahamas, Cuba, would have been great in 1950, Puerto Rico, Hawaii, and I'll look in the other half of the world if you want me to. Mm-hmm. All he was saying is there's karst topography, lots of places, mm-hmm. and that's just what you want to get the hole you're looking for.
So the tropical location was not dictated by ionospheric economics?
No, the point there, I think, was that there was a great deal to do in the ionosphere no matter where you did it.
Yeah,
And there was only one region in which you could do the planets as long as you had this limit on the scan, and so it roughly said the tropics.
Was there anyone who particularly pushed the radar astronomy side, or was it just sort of everyone agreed that...
At that stage, it was simply a fringe benefit of the... And I think, at Cornell, in those days, we didn't really have a radar astronomer.
I don't think so, no.
No, we didn't. Mm. So it was simply said to be a fringe benefit of the system, and it was also obvious that if you had a collecting area of 1,000 feet, that there were going to be some radio astronomers who would have some interests also.
Well, right. Now, that's what I wanted to ask. It seems to me that that could be argued at that point to be even more beneficial than the radar astronomy side. Was that so, or was that just even more minor than the radar astronomy?
I think it went in that order, that it was developed to do ionospheric things, that it was apparent that that powerful a radar would be useful as a radar in radar astronomy, and the collector without the transmitter would have some use in radio astronomy. And so those were kind of the fringe benefits of building a big system.
But there was nothing that happened, for instance, like the U.S. radio astronomical community coming and saying, well, gee, this is fantastic.
You know, in many ways, you can say those were the good old days, but there were no committees. We had to convince and continually sell and resell the people in ARPA. And they would get uneasy because they didn't really know whether incoherent scatter was just a crazy idea or whether it had some substance. And they would come up, they'd get uneasy and call me then, and they'd say, you know, there's a plasma physicist at Princeton. Why don't you go tell him what you're thinking about, and then I'll talk to him. And it was sort of test.
Yeah, right.
And that came. That was repeated in many different ways at many different times, and we never had the community of the community of aeronomers or the community of the astronomers who voted and said this is a high priority item and I want to proceed. It was proceeding as a very small part of the ARPA budget, of course.
Yeah. But a very big part of ionospheric science and this sort of thing.
Of course.
Were the ionospheric physicists?
They were excited, in a sense we weren't. They didn't feel threatened because we weren't going after NSF money, we weren't going after ONR money or Air Force money, which were the sources at those times, and they could see it as a kind of a big boost for everyone. And it's kind of a nice side comment on the support of science. In a sense, we were diverting a bit of the military funding to science, and we're happy to do that. And but on the other hand, I must say, it did what we wanted to do at Cornell and what the military needed to know. It did coincide.
That's what I was just going to ask you. Did you have to make any compromises?
No, I don't think so.
For the military's sake.
And we, their interests frequently were of a classified nature. I'm not sure for good reason, but they were. It doesn't matter. And our interests were just in discovering something about learning more about the upper atmosphere. And I think it's fair to say they needed to learn more about the upper atmosphere, and so they were sort of willing to go along with us, in effect.
But in fact, there were no secret projects ever done in the thing.
The project was never classified. We were out in the in the 50s, you could have done classified work on the campus, but you couldn't have in the 60s.
We didn't. Only to the late 60s, really.
Yeah. And there was some sensitivity in Puerto Rico, too. The Puerto Ricans were, I suppose, a bit suspicious that we were some big military thing coming in, like all of the bases that
they still are, of course.
Yeah.
But now, what about the final choice of Puerto Rico? What led to that?
That was an interesting choice. By accident, we had had a professor from the University of Puerto Rico at Mayagüez, who was a student at Cornell. He was sent there to get his PhD, and he worked with Henry Booker and with me, and got a degree, and he got it must have been in the middle 50s. And that gave us a sort of a lead into Puerto Rico. His name is Dueño, D-U-E-N-O. And Dueño was most cooperative, and Puerto Rico was a freely associated state. It was, in a sense, part of the U.S. So
you didn't have diplomatic problems.
No, it removed a whole series of problems. And as soon as we contacted Dueño and said they would like to come down and look at sites and come down and do radio surveys of the noise levels and so on, we got a warm reception. You could say the same thing about Hawaii, I think, except it was much, much further away from Cornell. So the choice was pretty simple. I think our civil engineer man looked at the aerial photographs of Puerto Rico and said, here are a dozen possibilities of holes in the ground and roughly the dimensions you need. And we looked at some and said, well, that's too close to a town or a city or something. Very, very quickly reduced it to three, and he and I went down and looked at the three and
picked up one. While you mentioned the size, I noticed in one of these abstracts for a 1960 Cornell report that it mentions a 1,500-foot dish. Did that get dwindled down at some point?
Okay. There was a an early stage when there was an option that we would build the 1,000-foot dish, but if you... The choice was the following. You could build a feed that would illuminate the full 1,000 feet when you look straight up. Then if you look anywhere off of the vertical, you have some vignetting and some loss of gain. You could avoid that if you built something like a 1,500-foot dish and illuminated the 1,000. And so we proposed it as an option at one stage for some additional funding. I've forgotten the details at the moment.
I see.
And it was not sold. We weren't pushing it very hard. From the ionosphere point of view, we were mostly interested in looking straight up anyway. Yeah. So it didn't succeed. It was tried, but not successfully. Now, it's interesting to note that the S-band feed that is currently in use does illuminate only 200 meters
of
the 300, and doesn't have the vignetting when the
Deuce came. So, in fact, if it had been 1,500, then now we would have a wider... No, that's not true. You still have to have more track upstairs to go further than 20 degrees.
You have to extend the track. You use fully the track that's there to do the 20-degree scan.
Okay, so when was this project finally approved, and what was the budget?
The idea first occurred to me in the spring of 1958, that scattering from electrons, although terribly weak, was measurable with high technology, but of it more or less available equipment, leaving out the 1,000-foot dish as an off-the-shelf item. and by the middle of 1960, there were, from Cornell, there were five families who moved to Puerto Rico to seriously begin the construction.
Mm-hmm.
That's two years and a couple months later. 3 years later, the facility was dedicated. Still needed a lot of tuning up.
But it was 1963,
November 63. And it's been going great ever since. With more money being poured in, a new surface, a new heating facility.
Now, what was the cost in 1960?
In 1960, the delivered cost was something like $9 million. 1963.
Mm-hmm. And were there any difficulties, or did it all go pretty smoothly as far as...
There were lots of difficulties. Looking back on them, they all sort of fell into place, but you never knew from one day to the next whether...
Well, can you tell me what the major ones were?
One of the major ones was our difficulties with managing a dozen subcontractors, each with major contracts, and sort of getting in each other's way. Trying to keep them from running up the bill in effect. There were difficulties in Sugar Grove was being turned off while we were building. That had some impact.
That maybe you also were a big white elephant?
Of course. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There were lots of people who said you couldn't build a 1,000-foot dish to the specs that we were talking about. As it turned out, Kavanaugh and his designers produced a scheme for the surface, which has just been repeated. In the new surface, the support is Kavanaugh's original technique, just used more often. The problems did get solved. People like Merle Lalonde, who was the chief engineer, a remarkable fellow, could get these people working together.
Lalonde was the chief engineer for the whole project?
Yeah.
I know him only recently from the feeds.
And unfortunately he died recently.
Right.
Yeah, and he's